One thing we're critically aware of at Gartner is that nobody knows everything. It's impossible. We don't want to have the analysts try and answer a question that they really don't know that much about, because it impacts Gartner's credibility.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the HIP Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Duby, Principal Technologist Americas at Semperis. The name Gartner is everywhere in the technology world, especially in management. ChatGPT's description of the company is that Gartner is a global research and advisory firm that focuses on business and technology. It sells research, consulting, and conferences to help executives and IT leaders make decisions about technology strategy, vendors, and investments. Coincidentally, I just spoke at a Gartner conference in Sydney, the Security and Risk Management Summit. They also run an IAM summit every December. And you can tell the growth and visibility of identity in the market by the number of new attendee hands raised every year there. The organization has more than 2,400 analysts across many areas, focusing on IT, technology, and business leaders. They're especially known for frameworks like the Magic Quadrant, which are vendor comparisons in a given market, and the Hype Cycle, stages of emerging technology maturity. And as someone that has looked at the Hype Cycle for many years, you start seeing Hype Cycle in all kinds of places in the world, not just specifically IT. It's very valuable. If you have never looked at it, just go do a quick look for Hype Cycle and look at the different ones that have been published. But perhaps not as widely known, they also listen to thousands of customers asking and answering questions. They use this broad and deep view of a topic very few of us have for the next step most of us are reluctant to take, which are predictions. If you're aware of them, you probably have a positive or a negative view of them, as professional soothsaying is a tricky business. Love them or hate them, they are the most significant strategy influencer in the technology business. Even my Microsoft Office autocorrect tells me I should capitalize the name. But have you ever wondered, this being an identity podcast, have you ever wondered what exactly they do around identity? And more to the point, what are they seeing percolating up from many customer conversations and their research? So my guest today is my friend Mark Diodati. Mark is Managing Vice President for Identity and Access Management at Gartner. He's a longtime identity pioneer who helps shape the way the industry thinks about authentication, privileged access management, and cloud identity. He leads a large team of analysts, sets the global IAM research agenda, and rigorously reviews every document to keep the bar high. Before that, he guided Gartner's IAM research for technical professionals, chaired major industry conferences like Catalyst Europe and the Cloud Identity Summit, and drove triple-digit growth in the attendance and sponsorships. Earlier in his career, he held key leadership roles at CA, RSA, and Ping Identity, influencing product strategy and partnerships that many identity practitioners rely on today. Mark and I met long ago, back when only the identerati thought identity was cool, at a cloud identity summit in Las Vegas, and bonded over our love of traditional Irish and Celtic music.
Yeah.
Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks, John. That's good to be here.
Okay, so let me get this first one out of the way, because otherwise I expect it will distract people from our conversation until you explain it. What the heck is that surrealist guitar behind you?
Oh, that is my new harp guitar that I just got. And so I'm a big fan of Michael Hedges. Sean and I talk about music all the time. And Sean's right, we bonded over some music discussions. But we talk about, Sean and I have a standing meeting, I think every other week or so. We talk about music stuff, just catch up. And he's a big fan of Pat Metheny and some jazz stuff. We talk about that. But, you know, Sean listens to Michael Hedges too. And so I'm learning a new, it's kind of a new instrument. It's really, yeah, it's got one neck like a regular guitar, but then it has these bass strings that are separate. And there's a lot of independence of hand movement that's required. So it's, you know, it feels like my brain is breaking when I play it, you know, but I'm really excited to have it. I've always wanted to get a harp guitar and you know, held off on it. They're not generally made. You can't, you know, it's not like they roll off the factory. So, you know, I waited a couple months and I talked to somebody about it and picked one up, and it's been real fun. It's a lot of fun.
With your characteristic understatement, you called it a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah. And
And this is from a guy that's already playing Michael Hedges style guitar.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
Mark was actually the music. What would you call it? You were the talent for Cloud Identity Summit back in Chicago.
Yeah.
At lunchtime, you were the lunch music guy.
Yeah, it was great fun. I was happy to do it. Yeah.
And you play a regular gig in Milwaukee.
I do.
At a wine bar, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I play solo fingerstyle guitar. So I do some singing, but not much. So it's definitely not, you're not going to hear Jimmy Buffett or, whatever your favorite cover du jour is. I love all that stuff. So wine bars are great. I go in and set up and, I have 40 odd pieces or, pretty intricate. Some of them are pop song arrangements, but they're all in different tunings. I play in like 15 different tunings. I'm one of those weird kind of acoustic guitar players. Yeah, I love it. I love doing it.
Well, it is a little bit difficult to sing to a Michael Hedges style fingerstyle guitar.
Yeah, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Okay, so we'll return to that a little bit later, but let's actually talk about your day job right now.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the company in general for a minute. What are the major pillars of what Gartner does?
Yeah, I think you referenced a chunk of it in the intro, which was really great. Thank you. Gartner's pretty huge. I think a lot of people don't understand it. I think in Q4 we did $1.8 billion in revenue.
Wow.
For Fortune 500, we own 73% of the clients. Our clients are in there. That number is considerably higher for the top 100. It's somewhere between 80 and 85%. And for Global 1000, 60 to 65%. So we're pretty big. And there's three major parts of the business, what we call business and technology insights. That's research. That's probably where most people know about Gartner. And then conferences, which you talked about. And by the way, I heard great things about your SRM talk.
Oh, really?
Thank you for doing that. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I would say conferences somewhere between 15 and 20% of our business. And then the last part is what we would call consulting, but it is such a small, small, small part of the business, percentage digits of business. The biggest part is what we do, which was the BTI. We called it research. It's been called analyst and advisory. And yeah, so being an analyst is a pretty great job because you spend probably 300 or 400 man hours a year talking to clients directly. We call it an inquiry, where they'll call with a set of questions about something or some challenge that they're having with an identity. And if you're an analyst and you're talking to that many clients of that size and stature, right, and you're also talking to the vendors, you have a view of the industry and the technology that I think is really hard to replicate anywhere else because we're just seeing it all. To your comment about making predictions and so on, I always joke, and it's not really true, but if you have half a brain and you're listening to all these clients telling you what they're struggling with, right, and what they're working on, and you have key insights into the vendor roadmap before anybody else does, with the Microsofts, the AWSs of the world, and so on. The ability to think about what the market's going to look like or make predictions, out 18 months, 3 years, 5 years is I call it half a brain. It's not really half a brain to do it, but it's a great job. And we like to talk about it too among ourselves. Is it's like getting a master's degree every day because you're constantly learning. So if you're a curious person, it's a great gig. Yeah.
Yeah. So really, it is. It takes an endlessly curious person with, let's face it, an ordered mind.
Yeah.
But then crucially, I know after having talked to you for many years, you have to be able to write.
I mean,
the ChatGPT aside and all that sort of thing. You have to be able to synthesize what you've seen. And there's lots of people that can listen to these things. And yeah, but it's the synthesis that is really the key.
Yeah, it's interesting because the job can be really challenging from a time management perspective. The challenge is to carve out enough time that you can hit a writing groove, right? We all know you can't. I personally can't sit and write something deep in 20 minutes. I've got to settle in and I've got to do whatever. So analysts are constantly in this time management approach of managing time with clients versus meeting with what we call cohorts, which are colleagues covering the same topic, and finding time to write. And when we hire for analysts, we're looking for four things, basically. We're looking for people with really good interpersonal skills, communication skills. not only to potentially clients, right, but also internally, because we deeply value our team culture. And what we don't want is some ego-driven analyst coming in and stomping on the conversation that prevents us from getting to the right answer to things. We look for people with great writing skills. We're looking for people who are technologists. And then finally, we're looking for people with stagecraft. And you never, when we hire, we never find people with all four of those things all at once, because it's what we call the Gartner way. So not only do you have to come in and you have to be a good writer, but then there's the style and the use of the templates that we use, like an MQ you mentioned, or, you know, a guidance framework. They're all different. And it, I would say it takes 12 to 18 months for an analyst to be able to pick up that writing capability. It's a learning curve, but it's a big part of the job.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, if you've been to very many conferences, you of all stripes, you'll meet Gartner analysts. And so there is a, you know, there is a type or whatever of a Gartner analyst. And so, yeah, it's like you're talking about the training of that. You're talking about the writing aspect of it. And I've shown this to you before, but I think this is so appropriate. I've had this on my on underneath my monitor for years. Inspiration is for amateurs.
Right.
It's like, okay, you've got 2 hours to compose something. You need to put down 500 words on a topic about X, Y, and Z. And we've all been there. Any of us that have written, and you and I have both written for many, many years. It's like, yeah, but I want to look at this email. Oh, there's that Teams message.
All the stuff turning your way.
Push it aside.
And by the way, I've read your Windows IT Pro writing stuff and other things online. You're an exceptional writer. And writing, I mean, starting back, one of the things that really impressed me was you literally wrote the book on Active Directory, I think, back in the day, which was quite a.
Well, I wrote a book on it. The book is an O'Reilly one, which I still have here in the corner. Yeah, I still have it in the corner. Yeah. It started out with Joe Richards and then Brian Desmond and folks like that. But yeah, I wrote a book on Windows 2000 server, and I had a bunch of things about it, but the core that I remember about it was writing about Active Directory.
Yeah.
And I years ago, I think it was translated into Chinese, and years ago I picked up the book, you know, for all five people that bought it, and I just opened some random page and I saw that somehow I had written OU as something other than organizational unit. And I went, oh my God, I can't stand. And I've never looked at the book since. I keep a Chinese copy there that I can't read, so I can't be embarrassed by it.
That's great. Yeah.
But anyway, back to Gartner. So what does Gartner do that people may not know about so much? You mentioned the sort of the consulting. What other things, what does Gartner do?
So within that research area, I think what many organizations may not realize is that we're taking information from a lot of different places. And one of the things that we're using is GenAI to pull that information together and do it so in a way that's privacy protecting, right? So we have NDA with all our clients. But the kinds of challenges that we're working through, you know, if I'm speaking to, you know, clients 300 or 400 man hours a year, I have the ability to take that information in and synthesize it within a learning model. And at the same time, again, talking to vendors and so on, all of that information results in something that you can't get anywhere else, right? Like if you go to a ChatGPT or you go to another tool, you might get something that you, if you asked for some information and asked it to, you know, put it in a Gartner style, you might get something that, you know, if you squint, looks like Gartner stuff, but it's built on a set of knowledge that isn't ours, right? We have all of this information from all of our clients. So what we try to do is synthesize that. And then we also have places where, you know, we have communities where our clients come in too, and they're asking questions of each other and everything else. So our ability to take all that information from a variety of different places, its destination is not just a research document. It informs all of our inquiries with other clients too, and the industry.
Oh, that's so super powerful. You have your own Gen AI, your own large language model that has visibility into your own research and your own conversations. And so you can ask questions that very quickly, I must say, jillions of hours of analysts asking questions about things instead of having to troll through interviews and all that.
Yeah, I think I hope this is numbers right, but I think we did 500,000 increase with clients last year. All of it is fed into our learning model. All of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we're talking about listening to customers. What's it like for a Gartner analyst for listening to customers and their customer interaction? How much do they spend per week talking to customers? And what are the details of what a Gartner inquiry is from both sides, really?
Yeah. So typically spending somewhere between 15 and 20 hours per week talking to clients.
Okay. Almost half their time.
Almost half their time, which is why that time management thing is so critical to find time to write. And occasionally we'll do things like, we'll do sprints. So when I know an analyst is ready, they've done their research, research is concluded, I'll take them out of the inquiry system for a couple of days. And I'll just say, you have no meetings, go, stand in front of whatever you need, go write. Because that groove thing is something, I don't know what that old software engineering book, The Mythical Man Month, if you could take, all hours are not the same, right? And so you need to provide a cluster of hours that an analyst can write to.
And as a writer, I know that I write much better first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
Than I do like in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And so if I have something to get done, that's how I try to shift things.
Isn't that funny? Like for me, my power hours for writing are in the afternoon. They just are. And it seems to be unique to everybody. And what we have to try and balance is when we're handling inquiry load, analysts they have to keep about half of their calendar open on a given day so that inquiries can be booked. But there's also a time zone element too. So, when we hire, we hire for people in Europe, we hire for people in Asia Pac, we hire for people in North America. But inevitably, the UK folks are a little quieter in the morning because Europe, or America hasn't woken up yet, so they're not going to get as much inquiry, right? So there's also a time zone dimension that impacts when analysts can write, in addition to all those kinds of things you and I talk about, like power hours of when we feel good and feel lucid and can write.
So what's it like for a customer that wants to do an inquiry? How does that go about, and what happens in the course of the inquiry, and what happens after an inquiry?
Oh, yeah, it's really interesting. So typically, they'll go through a self-service interface where they can ask a question and, it's natural language. Or they have a representative, sometimes called an executive partner, that they might call up and say, well, I'm thinking of this. And maybe the executive partner will open up the inquiry for them. And from there, we have this group called Client Engagement Services. And we have this whole learning knowledge system built in that does its best guess to figure out who's the best analyst to cover that topic. So we spent a lot of time identifying topic coverage areas, which we can talk about. I'm responsible for that for my team. And that is used, we give that to our client engagement services that feeds their system. And then of course, because questions can be ambiguous, I get a lot of them back that say, hey, this is what the clients tell me, I'm not really sure, right? What does this look like to you? And I'll say, oh, that's great. Rebecca can cover that. Why don't you, book it with her? From there, that part of the analyst keeping their calendar open for inquiry enables us to book inquiries on the fly, right? So we have dedicated time. That is largely an automated process. There are occasionally times when a client needs an answer that we can't get on an analyst calendar soon enough. And then we'll do some, negotiating and handshaking. We'll try and move things around a little bit to make that happen. Once they get on the call, our best analysts, really, this is how we coach them, they're there to just listen at first. So what is it you're struggling with? What are you seeing? And then the client will share some perspectives, and then the analyst will ask a series of questions to help refine the answer that they might need. Like, I'm looking for, an identity verification system. It needs to work in an airport and a hospital. Okay, let's talk about that. Are you using hardware-based credentials to do that? How do you plan to do that? Are you distributed? Do you have just one office or many offices? Are you remote? There are all these questions that the analyst will ask, and then there'll be a discussion. The analyst will make a series of recommendations and talk about it with the client. And also what'll happen too is that occasionally towards the end of that, it might be clear that The analyst doesn't have an answer to an auxiliary question, right? So it might be, they come in for an identity topic, but then really they need to go to data analytics because they're looking up. They need something maybe with, NoSQL or, a graph database on Amazon, right? We don't, one thing we're critically aware of at Gartner is that nobody knows everything. It's impossible.
Leading up to my next question.
Yeah, right.
How do you handle that? Right.
Yeah. And we have to handle it, really carefully, because we don't want to have the analyst try and answer a question that they really don't know that much about, because it impacts Gartner's credibility, right? So we much rather say, I think this is what's going on, but really you ought to talk to Doug over in data analytics and he can give you the right answer. So out of an inquiry might come next steps. What should we do next? Oh, you need to talk to Doug. And so we'll document that and ensure that the workflow actually works to get them in contact with Doug.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, I was a consultant for years.
Yeah.
And there's always this tension between the salespeople that say, oh, never say no or never say you can't, and us sitting across from a technical person that recognizes BS when he hears it.
Yes.
Or ultimately has more credibility if you say you don't know, because we all live in world, my gosh, with AI, there's so much we don't know. But to be able to say, well, we've got this, you probably don't put it like this, but we have this incredible LLM that I can, I can dig in and get you the answer. Because ultimately, my conceit is that they would, an inquirer, a customer, would much rather prefer to get the right answer, period, than getting something off the top of your head.
Right.
Because you're sitting across from somebody.
Yeah, oh, that's for sure. And it's really interesting, the way we hire for analysts is, because we're so concerned about this, is we'll find some people, I'll meet with them to what I would consider, an SME fit for analyst kind of conversation, but largely fit for analysts. Do they, based on those four areas we're looking for, does it look like they have something? And then I'll put them, we'll put them through three interviews with folks on my team who will, in a very respectful, collegial way, try to define the perimeter of their knowledge, right? Because nobody knows everything. And we need to understand, you're a privileged access management person, you're an authentication person, you're a little both, right? And then, if all of that goes well, we take them to, we ask them to write a research note, because we need to see if they can write. And nowadays with ChatGPT and other things, we have ways to ensure that we're getting the real deal.
You'd have to, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then with the next step we take them to is the panel, where myself, people from my team, people from another team, will get on the call and the analyst will present, or the interviewee will present on their research topic. They'll spend about 20 minutes presenting. And then in a way that kind of simulates what an inquiry might be like, we ask a lot of questions and we see, first of all, it proves out whether they wrote the document too, because we can now have an understanding of really what they know if they've written in the document. But also, we're going to push in a way that a client might push. And if we hear, things like answering questions that they don't know the answer to, if we hear any kind of, for lack of a better term, bullshitting, that's the end of it. That's the end. That's the end of the interview. It's over. You can't proceed any farther. And we do have that similar test in some of those SME interviews too. Like if we feel that the person is just going to kind of try and stretch or bullshit or talk about something, it's just a non-starter here. We can't hire that person.
Right. Right. That's so interesting. It sounds a lot like defending a master's thesis, the idea, and maybe where it came from. Well, this is an identity podcast. So what are some Gartner products that identity focused practitioners and management would be interested in?
Yeah. So that research, business technology insights, what you're doing is you're buying a license. So you could buy a license for, Gartner for CISOs or Gartner for Identity Access Management Leaders. You'd also buy a Gartner for Technical Professionals license too. And in some cases, those are bundled. But what you're buying is access to the research, and you're buying access to inquiry. So these inquiry calls, like I described, I would consider them a half hour, an hour long, tightly scoped consulting engagement, that are analyst engagement. So you have access to that. You can get in the calendar. You can access into, you can ask questions of our Gen AI system, our internal JAI system, where we're taking all that information. That's what you're buying access to. And it's a subscription model. So, you know, we are hyper-concerned around things like client engagement. So we want to make sure we know that if our clients are engaging, they're more likely to renew. So that's something we keep an eye on. But those are, in essence, the products that you're buying within within BTI Research. And then, you know, the, like I said, 15, 20% of our business and conferences, you're buying an attendee pass. Yeah, that's part of our money. That's how we do it.
So, Mark, tell me a little bit more about the Gartner for Technical Professionals subscription.
Right. So that is the audience for that is technical practitioners, the folks who are, they may have a people leadership position, but they also have some sort of practitioner element, or they may be pure play practitioners, architects, and so on. And that is licensed typically to the entire organization. So in that case, the entire organization can schedule an inquiry. They can get access to the research that's for Gartner for Technical Professionals. We have Gartner for Leaders, which is a little bit different. That's seat-based. And so you'd be purchasing a seat, and that means that you get access to the research. And then there are some cases that, you know, we put stuff out beyond the paywall, too, where we're sharing stuff that really isn't license-based, but we think it's important for people to get access to. So it depends on the kind of audience you have.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So with a Gartner for Technical Professionals subscription, which is a license subscription, which applies to a lot of this audience.
Yeah.
What that means is that if they want to find out something that Gartner Research has done in an area, maybe a vendor comparison or where things are going, that it's available to them. It's a resource that's available to them, which would be super valuable.
For sure. Yeah. And the, I came up through the technical professionals background. I started at Bird Group in 2005, left in 2012, went to work for Ping Identity for a few years, and then came back. Those guys are technical. You know, it's not uncommon for them to write code. It's not uncommon for them to maintain their own environments. You know, I would typically, you know, when I'm, it would be very common for me to do research and bring on stage how you would integrate identity in GCP, Azure, and AWS, for example, using OpenID Connect. You know, those guys know the stuff, and they're talking to a ton of clients. So, and with a GTP license, really, you have the opportunity to actually go talk to them and get the research. So within your organization, you might want to find out who actually is responsible for managing the license and get yourself a user account.
Right. Okay. So there's a takeaway from this podcast is you should check to see if your organization has this, which means you may have access to Gartner Research that you didn't even know was there.
Yeah.
So a little bit more specifically, what sort of topics is your team working on at the moment? What are your customers asking about? What's top of mind?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So we go through and periodically make sure that our topic, we call it a topic coverage area map, is aligning up with not only what we're seeing in the past, but also what we're anticipating in the future. And so, you know, some examples include advanced authentication and verification. The verification part is new, relatively speaking, as a market. That product, or IDV products, we call it, were typically, you know, I don't know, a few years ago, you'd buy like a Duo multi-factor authentication solution and you'd have the verification built in. But what we've seen is that there's been a commoditization of multi-factor authentication into cloud platforms. And so now that verification thing has become very niche. That's the part that remains that's kind of niche-y and is about how you prove a user, identity proof a user before they have their credential, or in specific environments like a hospital, if you're a clinician, or if you're in an airport. Authorization is really interesting as well. And so authorization has been one of those hard nuts to crack. You know,
sure has.
Yeah. And we all remember the days of Zacamal and the promise of interoperability. But there have been some emerging standards like OPA, which I think is Open Policy Agent, where it's a bit more friendly way to try and integrate authorization. So this renewed interest in an interoperability perspective. Consumer IAM is a big one. That's where we see a lot of innovation around all those things that you have to do with people who don't work in your organization. You can't make them carry a laptop, can't make them carry a push device. What are those things you can do behind the scenes? And that is an area where, example, Gen AI or AI in general is becoming more popular to be able to sift through and find the needle in a haystack on things like attacks and so on. Decentralized identity is big. Program management for my team is big. Yeah, and architecture. So I manage the IT leaders. And so we have a lot of people who are thinking, how do I implement this at a scale? I'm not just worried about, you know, the configuration of, you know, this bit or that bit within the target app. I need a roadmap to scale. So we do a fair amount of that. We do identity governance and administration, you know, which was provisioning and then, you know, includes, you know, governance and access certification. Identity threat detection and response. That's a new market we're seeing. This is where...
Oh, that one.
Yeah, right. Because we have Semperis Directory Services Protector, right?
Yeah. We're smack in the... We were actually talking to you guys about identity threat detection and response before you had a name for it.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question before I forget, because I'm likely to do that. Decentralized identity. That's been in the works, and as in, again, this is, you can map this back to hype cycle, I guess.
Yeah.
It's been in the works for a long time. We've heard about it. We've seen tests about it and all that. And in the hype cycle, you know, there's the initial curve, and then there's the wonderfully named trough of disillusionment.
Right.
And then it's sort of this, the something of acceptance, basically, where it starts being actually used, and it may not even be all of that visible. Is decentralized identity getting to the point where it's starting to actually be used by enterprises?
No, it's still really early days. So we cover it. There's a lot of emerging things happening. It's still early, but it's inevitable, right? It's just
right.
The system of trust frameworks that are required to pull that off and the usability necessary to make it so that, you know, carrying your own identity is not something that, you know, it's like carrying a Bitcoin wallet to try and do your business with, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's still percolating, in other words.
Yeah.
Well, we have to throw out the, I almost feel like I'm not allowed to say it, to do it unless I put it, say those two letters AI.
Yeah.
I've gotten the word out there. What are you guys seeing around AI and identity?
Yeah, it's a really interesting space. We have a cohort called AI and Machine Identity. And, you know, there's some, they're different, but they're the same. Not the same, but they share some commonality. And I see two dimensions to it. And our analysts are talking about two dimensions. One is, what's the impact of a tool like AI on existing identity systems? Like identity governance and administration, boy, if you could really build or if you could incorporate a great AI tool where, you know, as you're looking at entitlements, you don't have to explain the metadata to the AI. You can just say, give me your best shot at this. Take a look and you tell me what these roles should be and what this access should be. And to do it at a level of entitlement that is not scalable otherwise, right? You know, sometimes, you know, take an example like SAP, where there are so many kinds of entitlements within an ERP system, very difficult for, you know, a human and an IGA system to be able to map it all out, all the way down to the lowest entitlement. Well, that's a great thing that you can actually, you know, use Gen AI for, or AI more specifically. And that doesn't mean you trust it, right? You never trust all that stuff, but it gives you a starting point to be able to look at and begin to work from. So we see that. And you could see how, you know, AI might be able to look at 1,000 different factors of a user session and be able to assist in continuous authentication, right? And we've seen some emergence of that.
I'm just thinking about what you're describing and thinking about the idea of having an AI-powered solution to go look into somebody's Active Directory environment and the group configuration and the service accounts that do and have don't have attestations and they're just the mess that is most, and being able to provide practical guidance for how do you climb out of this.
Yeah.
Because right now it's extremely difficult to do.
Oh yeah. Just the nature of the different users, the devices. Are you hybrid or
right.
what are the policies like? Yeah, for that, that's a great example. And then it may be by extension saying, okay, well, I have this Okta system and then I have an AWS system and I have AD. And by the way, my namespace isn't consistent. So, you know, S Doobie over here, Sean D over here. And I'm not even gonna write regular expression rules and try and feed this into, you know, something. I'm just gonna hand it over to the AI and let it do all of this for me.
Go look at it.
Yeah. Just tell me what you think. Doesn't mean you have to rely on it. It might, you know, come up with some great examples of, you know, how you could harmonize your namespace. And oh, by the way, probably give you the code to do it.
Right. Nice. Nice. Okay. I'm sorry. I interrupted. You were saying.
No. The other dimension is, well, how do you put guardrails around AI tools?
So, yes.
Yeah. And in that case, we're seeing a bifurcated approach. Some of it is within the AI tool itself, being careful about what kind of credentials it has to be able to do the things it needs to do. That's one choke point. Because if you take a look at the guts of some of the AI systems, you can't really, it's awfully hard to dictate where it's going to pull its answers from and build the response for you. Similarly, you don't want to give it access to a lot of stuff. You need to be very careful about it. So you can consider it like a machine identity in that case and say, okay, you know, you're not going to get an OAuth credential to go over here. And there's no way that you're going to, you know, be able to use Pixie to be able to do an identity-based protocol over here. So one way is to kind of keep it really slim and understand just what privilege, just like a machine one app, what privilege does that thing have to determine, you know, how you can protect privacy and data. And then the other area is on the target platform for themselves, where the Gen AI tool might reach out. What are the set of guardrails that you can put in around those target platforms where it is reaching out? So it requires a combination of the two of those. And I have to say, we're looking at it, we're providing guidance on it, but it's really still early days for that.
I just did a podcast with my colleague, Sarah Cicchetti, and you know Sarah, the mainstay at Cloud Identity Summit, Identiverse.
Yeah.
And she was talking about CEDAR authorization framework that she helped develop at AWS to put guardrails around what an agent can do and what it can't do. Yeah. Even if it thinks, she had a great example of a researcher that used an AI agent that thought it was great and started deleting everything in her inbox. And she had, it was running on a Mac Mini, and she said, I was like running across the room, like trying to defuse a bomb to unplug the Mac Mini from the internet.
Right.
And that CEDAR puts guardrails around it, that even if the AI system thinks it's doing something and it's not,
yeah,
it still doesn't let it do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's insured. Wow. It's reassuring to know that this is going on, but this is still, from my understanding, very much in the, everybody's trying something right now. There's not any one thing or one or two things that have emerged.
Yeah, it was just, I was reading something in the Times yesterday, today, like Claude pulled back a new engine. It begins with M, slipping my mind, but they pulled it back because the thing was so good at writing code and therefore detecting or knowing what good code looks like, that they sort of opened it up and it found thousands of vulnerabilities in mainstay applications like browsers and everything else. So yeah, it's frightening just how fast that's moving.
Sarah wrote she has a test environment, and she's using Claude right now, so she named it Claudry Hepburn.
I love it. Yeah.
And Claudry as a company is posting on LinkedIn about its evolution.
Oh, that's great.
Of that. So look up Claudry Hepburn, anybody that's interested in following along those experiments. So
yeah, she's pretty talented. I've had a few conversations with her over the years.
Yeah, she really is. We're really lucky to have her.
Yeah.
Because it's just as tantalizing to not have heard a harp guitar as it is to know what it looks like, I've asked you if you could maybe play a little bit for us.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm still really new at it, but I have my other guitar here. Can I try something else?
Sure, but could you at least play maybe a few chords on the harp guitar?
Yeah. So, and we might have to, I don't know how our sound noise reduction is going to be, but in essence, of course, you know, it's a Michael Hedges kind of thing. And so it's in a, it's not in standard tuning. And so what a lot of what happens with him in playing is he's doing something like this. And so you can tell I'm a total hack at it. But the idea would be that while this name is doing something, one hand's doing this. That's the idea. But yeah, I just got it a couple weeks ago, so I'm even embarrassed.
Yeah, I don't want to put you on the spot. But no, just to see and hear the instrument alone is worthwhile. Yeah, if you wanted to play something else for us, that would be great.
All right, so... one of the first pieces I learned, I mean, I play a lot of stuff, right? But I do play, I'm talking about Michael Hedges all day, but playing a lot of Michael. And one of the interesting things about Michael Hedges was, I live part-time in Wisconsin anyways, as you know, and the guy who wrote a book with Michael Hedges, this guy John Strokes, lives in Wisconsin. He runs the guitar program at UW. Milwaukee. And so I got to study with him. And so it was really interesting. This literally, they wrote a book together. And also he has a collection of archive of Michael coming to his place in Wisconsin and they film him. And, you know, so it was like an exceptional multi kind of learning experience.
Yeah.
The thing about the Hedges pieces that's so mind blowing to me, and we're kind of geeking out musically, right? Is that if you were to play the Michael Hedges piece just as it's written on paper, it wouldn't sound like him at all. The reason is that while he's playing certain notes, he's stopping other strings that are resonating from playing. So not only are you picking a note, but you're using other parts of your hand to stop notes from ringing that would ring out naturally. So that, can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is...
Yeah, you can hear it fine. Cool. I recognize the piece, and it's for anyone that's never listened to Michael Hedges, that is the first tune on Aerial Boundaries. It's revelatory, and
yeah.
You're a great practitioner of the style. Man,
I obviously had a couple of flub notes at the beginning, but I was picking up a little raw. But that album's exceptional. Like this, the first four of songs on that album completely changed acoustic guitar playing. It's probably like the world looked like before Jimi Hendrix or Van Halen.
Right.
And after. That's Michael Hedges. It's just at one singular point in time that changed everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, man.
You
got all the multifacets. We've got, we even have the special musical treat here at the end.
Yeah, so let me play.
I appreciate it and love hearing the insight about, you know, what Gartner's all about. And go off and see if maybe you guys out there have Gartner for Technical Professionals subscription license
yeah.
and take advantage of it.
Yeah, you may have another license too. You may have a Lear's license you don't know about, right? That unfortunately is common. We try and make sure that that stuff gets used, but a lot of cases it's up to the organization to make sure they get the message out.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, thanks again, Mark.
Yeah, thanks,
Talk to you soon.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks so much for listening to the HIP Podcast, brought to you by Semperis, the leader in identity resilience. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to the show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And if you have a minute, please give us a rating or leave us a review, as that really helps other listeners find the show. You can find past episodes and more information at hipconf.com/podcasts. I'm Sean Doobie. Stay secure, and I'll see you in the next one.